week's parasha is parasha Vayishlach. Page 170, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lafanov, and Yaakov sent Malachim in front of him. Aleis of Achiv Tesev, his brother. Arts of Seir today Edoim, to the land of Seir, the field of Edoim. So Rashi comments on the word Malachim. What is the translation? What's the interpretation of the word Malachim here? It could mean, Malachim could mean angels. Malachim could be messengers. And Rashi tells us, Malachim Amish. Rashi follows the opinion of the Medrash that the Malachim that Yaakov sent were actual Malachim. Those people that he sent, that those when he sent the message to his brother Esav, he sent the message with actual angels. So Moshe Feinstein, Darash Moshe, asks as to why did Yaakov find it necessary to have to send angels? I mean, to send an angel is a, call it a miraculous experience. It's clearly not a natural experience. So when Yaakov seemingly has the opportunity to send regular, you know, flesh and blood messengers, why is he employing a miracle? There is a rule that, you know, if a miracle happens for a person, and I believe it means it in the context, if a miracle happens for a person when it wasn't maybe that necessary, I'm not sure what it means, I'm not sure that the context of this principle, there is an idea that if you experience a miracle, it knocks off some of your merits. You know, having a miracle, having a salvation through a miracle can cost. I don't know the exact context of that. But Reb Moshe, when he asks the question, he says, you know, if Yaakov is employing a angel when he doesn't need to, that would be at the cost of merits. So why is he doing it? Why is it so important for Yaakov to use angels? And therefore, Reb Moshe actually answers this in a very interesting way, in the sense of that actually Yaakov doesn't need to send angels. He could send regular human beings, but for Yaakov Avinu, there's no difference between sending an angel or sending a human being. And that's because that most of us react to a miracle differently than to a natural event. A natural event doesn't leave the same impression upon us as a miracle does. A miracle is inspiring. A miracle is something that wows us. And therefore, because when miracles occur, it has a certain mark on us. But then there are certain people, certain righteous people, certain great people, who actually rise to such a level of emuna. They rise to such a level of belief in Hashem. And the fact that Hashem runs the world is so clear to them that actually they see Hashem in nature. To them, there's no difference between nature and miracle. Miracle is where it becomes clearer that Hashem's hand, that Hashem is running the show. But for great people, to them, they look at nature and they can see in nature Hashem is running the show. And the fact that nature has that repetitiveness doesn't make a difference to them. It doesn't cloud their vision. They're able to see Hashem's hand in nature. So Yaakov Avinu, says Reb Moshe, is the kind of person that to him there is no difference whether something is a miracle because it's a change in the natural way of way things happen, or nature itself. Yaakov Rai has risen to the level that to him, a miracle, nature, it's the same thing. Nature is also the miracle. Nature is the same miracle. Nature is running by the hand of Hashem just as miracles do. And when a person writes to that level that the repetitiveness of the natural order doesn't affect them, they're beyond that, then they see Hashem in nature. There's no difference to them, there's no difference between nature and miracle. With this, Reb Moshe explains a very, very interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is referring to the story of Tanakh when Sanhedrin, the king of Asher, surrounded Jerusalem. The king at that time was Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And overnight, the entire army of Sanhedrin died in their sleep, and that's how Jerusalem was saved. And there is a discussion over the fact that this was clearly a miracle, clearly a very great salvation for the Jewish people, and Chizkiyahu HaMelech did not sing Shirim. The Jewish people, when they were saved by the splitting of the Red Sea, what do? They sang Shirim. They sang a song of thanks to Hashem. Chizkiyahu did not do so after that miracle of being saved from Sennacherib's armies. And because of that, the Gemara brings the following discussion. The Gemara says, "Bikesh Hakadosh Baruch Hu lasis Chizkiyahu Mashiach v'sancheiriv goy gumagig." Hakadosh Baruch Hu wanted that Chizkiyah should be Mashiach, and Sancheirim should be the fulfillment of the nations of Gog and Magog, who are supposed to have a war, which eventually Mashiach comes after. Amra Midas Hadin. So the attribute of judgment, the angel in charge of justice, said, Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, said before Hashem, Rebbeinu Shel, the master of the world. Omar David Melech Yisrael Sh'omar Kama Shiris V'Tishbachas L'Fanecha. David HaMelech, who composed many songs and praises before you, Loi Asise Mashiach, you didn't make him Mashiach, even though he made so much praises to you. Chizkiyahu Sh'asise Loi Kalanisim Alolu, Chizkiyahu, for whom you made so many miracles, Loi Yomar Shibur L'Fanecha, and he didn't say any praises before you, Ta'aseu Mashiach, him you're going to make Mashiach? There is a complaint against Chizkiyahu that he may be worthy of being Mashiach, but how can he be Mashiach if he hasn't sang any songs of praise to Hashem? Miyad Pascha Ha'aretz, immediately what came to the defense of Chizkiyahu? Ha'aretz, the earth. The earth opened up its mouth, so to speak, V'amar l'fanav, and said before him, Rebbeinu Shalaylam, Ani amaz l'fanecha shira tachas tzadik zeh. I say songs of praise in place of this righteous man. Vaseo Mashiach. And you make him Mashiach. Paschava Mashiva Lafarav, and the earth opened its mouth and said sang Shira, songs of praise before Hashem. So the Midas Hadin, the attribute of justice, says Chizkiyahu has no right to be king if he never sang any songs of praise to you with all the miracles that occurred for him. And the earth, the land, comes to stand up for Chizkiyahu and says to the Rebbeinu Shalom, let Chizkiyahu be Mashiach, I'll sing Shira. How does that work? How does that save Chizkiyahu? What's the pshat in this? So Moshe Feinstein says the pshat is based on what we just said. That Chizkiyahu HaMelech, why didn't he sing songs of praise to Hashem? Why didn't the miracle that occurred to him, why didn't it inspire him to sing songs of praise to Hashem? The answer is because Chizkiyahu HaMelech came to a point that he recognized the miracle happened, but to him every day was a miracle. Everything in creation was a miracle. To him there was no difference between nature and the miracle. And therefore he didn't sing a praise to Hashem, because as grateful as he was to Hashem, but the same way he doesn't sing praise to Hashem doesn't sing a special song of praise to Hashem for the creation every day, this miracle is just another one of the miracles that happens all the time. Everything is a miracle. Everything is the hand of Hashem. That's what it means, says Ramesha, that the earth opened its, or earth said, I will sing praise. Because if Chizkiyahu sings praise to Hashem for this miracle, then that means that by Chizkiyahu, the recognition of the hand of Hashem is clearer by a miracle than in nature. That's what it means. But if Chizkiyahu doesn't sing praise to Hashem, which means to Chizkiyahu, nature, miracle, are all the same miracle, then nature itself is singing the song of praise to Hashem. The miracle of nature is constantly here. The miracle of nature is constantly what is singing the praise of Hashem. Because by Chizkiyahu, nature is a constant miracle. And if you see the hand of Hashem in nature, then it's nature that's constantly singing the song of praise to Hashem. And that's why Chizkiyahu doesn't have to do that. So when the Gemara says that the Oretz, that the land said, I'll say Shira, I'll sing song of praise, and let Chizkiyahu be Mashiach, that was the way of, the Gemara is saying, that was the way of standing up for Chizkiyahu and saying, you know why Chizkiyahu didn't sing songs of praise to Hashem? Because by Chizkiyahu, what we call miracle in nature is the same. And if by Chizkiyahu that is the same, then it's the earth that is constantly singing song of praise to Hashem, and therefore there's no shortcoming on Chizkiyahu for not singing Shira, and he can be Mashiach. Therefore, Moshe says, this is the explanation with Yaakov. The reason why Yaakov is sending angels, and the reason why it's not going to cost him anything, is because if you come to the level of Yaakov, you come to the level where nature and miracle are the same, then there's no problem if miracles happen to you. The reason why we say that miracles don't happen for everyone is because if to a person who a miracle is different than nature, If Hashem constantly does miracles for that person, then what's going to happen? Then the miracles will become just like nature. He won't be inspired by nature. He won't be inspired by miracles. So for that person, we need to have we need to basically minimize miracles so that miracles mean something. And actually, if we get a miracle that, and sometimes for that person, a miracle, if at the end of the day he needs a miracle and he gets a miracle, it could actually cost him. But for Yaakov, who's on the level where miracle and nature are the same miracle, to him, miracles don't cost anything. He can have miracles all the time. Miracles won't affect him in a bad way. Constant miracles won't affect him, because by him, everything is clearly a miracle. And therefore, Yaakov sends the angels, and it doesn't cost him. And Rav Moshe says that we actually see this in a Gemara, famous Gemara in Tainus. Mechanina ben Doisa was, I guess, so poor that he wanted to light a candle, and his daughter said, actually, that's what the Gemara said. I don't think the Gemara says it that way. Actually, I think the Gemara says that his daughter accidentally filled the candelabra with vinegar instead of oil. So Chabrachin Mendeisa said, the one who tells oil to light can tell and will tell vinegar to light. And he lit the vinegar and it burned. So what's the pshat there? Why is he employing a miracle when he seemingly doesn't need to? Or maybe that's not the question there. But the whole point of Chabrachin Mendeisa's statement, says Ramesha, is that if by him there's no difference, then there's no difference. If by him it's so clear that the one who makes oil burn can make vinegar burn, then you know what? For him, vinegar will burn, because there's no difference to him. And that was Yaakov, and that's why he was able to send angels at no cost to him. Because by Yaakov, what we call miracles and nature is no difference. It's all the same miracle by Yaakov. Okay.
The original question was, why did he choose this
animal? No,
when he didn't have
them. Yeah, but the answer is, why can't he send angels?
They're not humans that are roaming around.
So actually, he just met a bunch of them before. At the end of Parshas Vayetze, he says he met angels. So he had angels. He had angels in hand. Okay. Let's now go back. Let's now continue. Vayetzav Oisem Leimar. And he commanded those angels to say, "Koisemru l'adoni la'esav." So shall you say to my master, to Esav. "Koyama adcha Yaakov." So says your servant Yaakov. "Im Lavan garti, I have lived with Lavan. Ve'echarad ata, and that's where I have delayed. That's where I have been until now." So Rashi comments on Yaakov's statement, "Im Lavan garti, I lived with Lavan." Rashi comments, it's the third line from the top of Rashi in the right column. Why is Yaakov choosing the word garti to say, I have lived with Esav now? Why do you use that word ger, which actually means stranger? And therefore, now the thing is, we do find this word to be used to mean live, but if all Yaakov meant to say was that he was living with Esav, there are other more commonly used words to express that. So therefore, the reason why Yaakov used the word garti, because he wants to use an expression of ger, of stranger, and Yaakov is trying to convey to Esav, "Lo'ina aseisi sar v'choshev elager, I did not become a distinguished person elager. I'm just a stranger. I'm not anything special. Ein cha kadai l'snei oisi albercha savicha shebarchani abegaver lachecha. You do not need to hate me for the blessings of your father that he blessed me, saying the words, Heve gevir lachecha, be a lord to your brother. Sharei v'yiskayma be, because look, it didn't happen to me. It wasn't fulfilled on me." So Yaakov is conveying a message to Esav, the word garti, that look, Yaakov, I know that you're angry at me for the blessings that I received from our father. Our father blessed me to be a gevir lachecha, to be gevir lachicha, to be a lord, to be a master to your brother. Well, look, that hasn't happened. So you have no reason to hate me. So what is Yaakov trying to say here? Trying to say to Esav, hey, you know those blessings? They're not for real anyway. Don't worry about it. That's what he's trying to say? What's he trying to say to Esav?
Yeah, we know there's one thing.
Well, that's the next Rashi. That's not this Rashi. That's the next part of Rashi, not this Rashi. This Rashi is saying, Garti is trying to say, look, the blessings weren't fulfilled, so you don't got to be upset with me. What's he trying to say? So based on what Ramesha Feinstein says, what we could say that Yaakov is saying to Esav is that what's the answer to this? Yaakov is saying to Esav, you know, this hasn't been fulfilled on me. So you know, so what's happening with Yitzchak's bracha? It's not coming true. It's not going to come true. I mean, what's the answer to this point? I believe the answer to this point is that if it doesn't happen now, it'll happen later. What Yaakov is saying to Esav is like this. You know, Esav, you're the kind of guy that you want things now. The bracha makes a difference to you if it happens now. If it doesn't happen now, then it doesn't make a difference to you. So if you're going to be upset with me that I got the blessings instead of you, which means I get the blessing to be a lord over you, I got that blessing, you're upset about that, well, guess what? It hasn't happened yet. And it's not going to happen right away. So therefore, you know what? For you, there's no point. You have no reason to be angry at me. For you, the blessing doesn't mean anything if you can't get it right away. That's the kind of person you are. You're the person who is looking for self-gratification. That's what Esav is about. He's the man who wants things now, and therefore, for you, Esav, there's no fulfillment of the blessing. So, you know, don't get upset. For me, I can wait.
Right, but he's also saying, look, I am going to get it, and I'm going to lord over you, and it might be a motivation to Esav to kill him now. It's like,
well,
I don't want it to happen.
You're taking it a little bit. You know, you're trying to put a allusion to it.
Yeah.
If we take it the way it is, Yaakov is trying to say to Esav, the blessings weren't fulfilled. Am I doubting the blessings of our father? No, I'm not doubting it. But for you, it's not fulfilled. For what matters to you, it's not fulfilled. The next Rashi, Davar Acher, what is Yaakov trying to convey to Esav with the word Garti? Garti begmatshia taryag. The numerical value of the word Garti, which means I have lived, is 613. And what's the point? Kolaymar, meaning to say, Im Lavan Arasha Garti, I have lived with the wicked Lavan, the Targ Mitzvah Shamarti, I have kept the 613 mitzvahs, and I did not learn from his evil ways. So, what's the message here? What is Yaakov trying to convey to Esav by saying that I lived with Laban who was evil, but I still kept 613 mitzvahs? What's the point? So, the simple one interpretation, which is Simcha Chachamim brings, others bring, is that after Yaakov took the blessings from Esav by Yitzchak, and Esav comes back to Yitzchak, and he's begging Yitzchak for blessings, Yitzchak does bless him and say, which means, as Rashi explains, that if there comes a point of time that you have a right to complain against Yaakov, meaning when Yaakov is not doing what he's supposed to do, so you now have a claim to say Yaakov does not deserve the blessings anymore, you will then be able to, you'll be able to throw off his yoke from you. So Esav knows, Yitzchak told Esav, that if Yaakov is not deserving, because he's not acting properly, then he will not be able to be controlled over you. You have control over him. So you love him, Esav can be thinking, Yaakov's been living for 20 years by Laban, you know, probably something rubbed off. And if something rubbed off, this is my chance. Yaakov sends the message. I lived with Laban. Garti. I kept the 613 mitzvahs. You will not be able to have any effect over me. I am still keeping my part of the deal that I get the blessings if I serve Hashem, if I do what I'm supposed to do, and that's where I'm still at. The Sivis HaChachamim brings a question that is asked, what does it mean that Yaakov says I kept 613 mitzvahs? Yaakov can't keep 613 mitzvahs. He can't. Is there a base of mikdash to bring kavanas in? No, he can't. There are a number of mitzvahs that Yaakov can't do. So what does it mean? How can he be saying, I kept 613 mitzvahs? The answer is that we have a principle that when you learn about the mitzvahs, it's like you've kept the mitzvah. Meaning when you have kavanas, of course you got to bring a carbon. But when we don't have karbanos, when we don't have sacrifices, for instance, when we study the laws of karbanos, Hashem considers it as if we brought karbanos. So therefore, Yaakov says, I kept 613 mitzvahs. Those that I could actually fulfill, I fulfilled. Those that I can't, I learned about, and my learning is considered as if I fulfilled them. Just want to tell you one more thought on this, again from Moshe Feinstein, and that is that Moshe says that Yaakov's message that I kept 613 mitzvahs is the following. Yaakov is telling Esav, in case you're thinking of a peace treaty, in case you're thinking of making peace with me, I want you to realize something. No matter what circumstances I've been under, even with 11, I have kept 613 mitzvahs. So if you want to speak peace in a way that I can still keep my 613 mitzvahs, fine. But if you think that, but if you want the kind of peace in which will become so peaceful and so close that I'm going to assimilate and therefore stop keeping 613 mitzvahs, that's, I'm not talking peace then. This was really, according to Reb Moshe's interpretation, this is a message to Esav. Whatever your plans may be, even if your plans are plans of peace, you have to realize that that peace that you want to make with me cannot be at the cost of my fulfillment of the 613 mitzvahs. That's not going to happen. The Beis HaLevi says that later on, when Yaakov hears that Esav is coming, so Yaakov davens to Hashem, Hatzileini na me'ad ochim ad Esav. Save me from the hands of my brother, from the hands of Esav. The Beis HaLevi explains that the reason why Yaakov says, from the hands of my brother, from the hands of Esav, is because Yaakov sees two dangers in Esav. A physical danger and a spiritual danger. When he's Esav, he's the evil Esav, then he's a physical threat. But when he's my brother, he's a spiritual threat. And that's what Yaakov davened to Hashem to be saved from both. Because Esav, by being brotherly, could be even more dangerous to Yaakov than if he wants to physically kill him. And this is what, according to Moshe, is the message of Targ Mitzvah Shamarti. You want to talk peace? Only the kind of peace that will not jeopardize my ability to keep the 613. Okay. Let's continue. So Yaakov sends the messengers to Esav, and what are the messengers come back and they say? By Yeshuv, this is a pasuk Zion, two lines from the bottom of the page. By Yeshuvu Hamalachim El Yaakov Lamar, and the angels return to Yaakov saying, Banu Elachich Al Esav, we have come to your brother to Esav, the Gamalech Lekraska, he is also coming to greet you, Va'abameas Ish Ima, and he has 400 men with him. Next pasuk, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayitzelei. Yaakov became very fearful and he became distressed. Vayachet Sazamah Shav Itoi Vesatzayim Vesabokar Vagmam Lishnei Machanais. And he split up the nation that was with him and the sheep and the cattle and the camels into two camps. Yaakov is preparing himself for war because that's what he sees Esav's reaction is to his gesture. 400 men coming. Rashi comments on the words Vayira Yaakov Ma'id Vayetzula. Yaakov was fearful and he was distressed. Rashi comments, this is a famous Rashi, Vayira Shema Yehareg. The first expression, when the Torah says Yaakov is fearful, it means Yaakov is fearful, perhaps he'll get killed. Vayetzula, what was distressing him? Imyareku Esacherim, if he will have to kill others. Okay, so the first Rashi, so Rashi says, let's analyze this Rashi. Rashi begins by saying that Yaakov is afraid that he may get killed. So the Sifta Chachamim brings a question, why was Yaakov afraid that he was going to get killed? We know that Esav, after Yaakov took the blessings after Yaakov got the blessings from Yitzchak, and after Esav realized and he begged his father for a blessing, and his father gave him some kind of a blessing, the Torah tells us that Esav decides he's going to kill Yaakov. But the pasuk says that Esav said, Yikrevu yemei evel avi. The days of mourning over my father are approaching. Vahaga siak es achi Yaakov, or Yaakov achi. And I will kill my brother Yaakov. Which means that Esav says, you know, my father's an old man. He's not going to live much longer. When the days of mourning come for my father, that's when I'm going to kill Yaakov. That would seem to be saying that Esav said he'll only kill Yaakov if Yitzchak's dead. We know that Yitzchak was still alive at this point of time. So what is Yaakov afraid of? Why is he afraid? Esav said he's not going to kill as long until the days of mourning for Yitzchak come. So what's he afraid of? So the Simcha Chachamim brings an answer. And another question is, we also know from the Rashi that Esav, when Yaakov left to go to Haran, who did Esav send? He sent Eliphaz to kill Yaakov. Why is he sending Eliphaz to kill Yaakov? Yitzchak still alive. So the Simcha Chachamim says the answer has to be that when Esav said, I'm not going to kill Yaakov until my father dies, Esav didn't know Yaakov was leaving at that point. Esav thinks Yaakov is sticking around. If Yaakov is sticking around and he's by Yitzchak, he's not going to kill Yaakov as long in front of Yitzchak. But if Yaakov is not there anymore, then to go in and kill Yaakov, that doesn't bother him if it's not happening actually, so to speak, in front of Yitzchak and Yitzchak's house. At this point, therefore, so once Yaakov left the house, he sent the Eliphaz to kill him. Now again, he's not by Yitzchak yet, and therefore Esav would not be wouldn't hesitate to kill him. He only hesitates to kill Yaakov when Yitzchak's alive, when they're actually in front of Yitzchak, so to speak, in the home of Yitzchak. Okay, now the second half of Rashi, where Rashi says, so the first thing is Yaakov is fearful that perhaps he will get killed. The second thing is, but then Yaakov is distressed over what? He's distressed over the fact that Shema im Yarugu es Acherim, if he has to kill others. That's what's bothering him. So the Simcha Chachamim again on this has a question. Okay. The question of the Simcha Chachamim is, why was Yaakov distressing over the fact that he may have to kill someone? We have a rule. If someone comes to kill you, what do? You kill him first. So what is Yaakov distressed over? If Esav comes to kill him, he has every right to kill him. If anybody comes to kill him, he has every right to kill him. So what is exactly bothering Yaakov? So therefore, the Simcha Chachamim suggests the following. He suggests that Yaakov is sizing up the situation like this. He's sizing up the situation. Who's going to kill him? Esav. Esav is going to want to kill him, right? Esav is going to reserve the right, going to reserve the opportunity to kill Yaakov. But it's not only going to be a war against Yaakov, it's going to be a war against Yaakov's people also, against his children, against his household. That'll be done by members of Esav's army. So Yaakov is not concerned about killing Esav if Esav comes to kill him. What Yaakov is concerned is like this. If Yaakov sees someone else trying to kill one of his people, does Yaakov have a right to go kill that person? Clearly. That person who's trying to kill someone else is called a rodef. He's pursuing someone to kill him. The person being pursued is called a nerdef. The same way you can kill someone who's trying to kill you to save yourself, you can kill someone else you can kill someone else to save a third person if that second person is trying to kill him. But there's a condition. You can only kill the rodef, you can only kill the we'll call him the murderer, in order to save the victim, if the only way you can save the victim is by killing him. But let's say you can pull out your gun and shoot him in the leg. Or let's say you can stop him some other way. Then if you kill him under those circumstances, you're a murderer. You weren't allowed to kill him then. So the only way that you can save someone else from someone who's trying to pursue him by killing that pursuer is if the only way to save the person is by killing him. But if you could just wound him, then that's what you have to do. So the Simcha Chachamim says that Yaakov was afraid that in the tumult of war, he may actually kill someone that he could have stopped by just wounding him. So that's Yaakov's concern. Yaakov's concern that if he has to kill someone, is a concern that he may kill someone wrongfully. The wrongful killing that would be if, in order to save someone else, he could have wounded the killer, and instead of wounding him, he actually killed him. That's Simcha Chachamim's explanation. Now, my question on the explanation is, and again, maybe I'm assuming something, my assumption is wrong, but it seems very interesting to me that in the middle of a war, this halacha applies. In the middle of a war, you have to start making a calculation. Oh, this guy I can shoot, I can wound, and this guy I can kill. In a classic case, is you have a person, an individual running after an individual. I mean, a classic case. I know for sure the halacha is if one person is chasing after another person to kill him. Okay, so if you can just wound the criminal, wound the killer. Okay, then that's what you got to do. But you have to start making those calculations in the middle of a war. So that's just my comment on this answer. Maybe you do. I don't know. Yeah. It would seem to me strange that in the middle of a war you should have to do that. And therefore, that would be my problem with this answer. What?
The other thing is, if he sees that he wants to kill him, Aesop is going after Yaakov.
No, that's
he
not.
He realizes that if he doesn't kill him,
no.
He'll turn him later on.
No. That's not what. Just to clarify,
yeah.
The Sifrei Chachamim is not saying that about Aesop. When Aesop is trying to kill Yaakov, if somebody's coming with you with a gun, right? My understanding is that person you can kill.
Oh, I thought you were saying
it's only when you're trying to save a third person.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm understanding of Sifrei Chachamim.
Okay.
When you're trying to deal with the third person, when you're trying to save a third person, okay, then you have to see, can I just stop the guy by wounding him, or do I need to kill him?
Okay.
I'm just saying, I'm kind of surprised that would be relevant in the middle of a war. That's just my question on this. I could be absolutely wrong. Maybe that's the halacha in a war too. Okay, that's the Sifrei Chachamim's approach. The Maral in Gur Aryeh, he has a different approach. Now, first, he actually brings an explanation that you shouldn't say. He first starts off saying like this: maybe you'll say that the reason why Yaakov is concerned about killing others is because, all right, clearly, anybody trying to kill you, you're allowed to fight the person. So if Aesop tries to kill him, he's allowed to protect himself, he can kill Aesop. If Aesop's men try to kill him, he can kill those men. How about, though, says the Gur Aryeh, maybe we should consider the following. Maybe some of Aesop's men didn't really want to come. They don't want to come to kill Yaakov. But Aesop has forced them. And therefore, the only reason why they're coming to kill Yaakov is because Aesop has forced them. So maybe things are different then. Says the Gur Aryeh, of course not. Because we know that if someone says to you, kill so-and-so or else I'm going to kill you, what's the halacha? You have to let yourself be killed. No such thing as being forced to kill someone.
That's for a Jew, it's not for anybody.
It could be for a guy also. If you got a guy, Sheva Mitzvah says Ritzicha. Murder is also one of the Sheva Mitzvahs.
Yeah.
I thought about that also, but I'm assuming that the Gur Aryeh is saying that since a guy is out of murder either, it's the same thing. He can't go ahead and just, he doesn't have that exemption.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so we can't say that. But maybe we should say, says the Gur Aryeh, or what we could say is the following. That there were men from Aesav that didn't want to come. Not only don't they want to come, they actually have no plans to kill. You know, Aesav is going to bring them, but you know what? In the middle of the tumult of everything, they're not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if Yaakov kills one of those people, okay, maybe then he did do something wrong. But says the Gur Aryeh, wait a minute. Let's analyze such a case, right? Somebody comes with an army to attack you. There are people there who have no plan to fight. But you don't know who those people are. So manavshach, as he says, manavshach. If you have a right to kill them, you have a right to kill them. If you don't have a right to kill them, then it's not appropriate to say Yaakov is distressed and will have to kill someone. He's not able to kill them. You don't say he's distressed over killing them. He's not able to kill them. So it has to be, says the Gur Aryeh, if you would say he's not,
yeah.
Then you couldn't say that that's why that Yaakov is distressed if he kills them. He's not allowed to. Finished. He's going to make sure he doesn't. Finished. Says the Gur Aryeh, Elamai, what we have to say is that, of course, if somebody comes with an army,
mm-hmm.
and you have no way, and my understanding what he's saying is, and you have no way of knowing which is the guy who's coming to kill and which guy's not coming to kill, but he came with an army, and you have no idea who's who, you have a right to protect yourself. No question about that. However, Yaakov saw that as like doing an unintentional sin, he calls it. Because at the end of the day, did I have a right to kill him? Yes. But what if he really was one of those people who never had any intention of killing anyone? So at the end of the day, I killed someone who really didn't deserve to die. Am I responsible for his death? Did I do something wrong in his death? Am I responsible? Would I be punished for his death as committing an act of murder? Definitely not. I had every right to protect myself, and I have no way of knowing who's who. But that, the Goraya says, he calls that's like a shogeg. That's like an unintentional sin. An unintentional sin is a sin. It doesn't carry the same responsibility as an intentional one, but an unintentional sin is a sin. You have responsibility for that. And therefore, that is how Yaakov saw this situation. Now, I think what we have to clarify here is that this situation is not like what we call a shogeg, when you do something unintentionally. Unintentionally means you didn't know it was wrong, you didn't learn that it was wrong, and you still have to seek atonement because you should have learned, you should have known. If it's because you forgot, well, that's also a certain level of negligence. I don't think we can say about Yaakov that Yaakov has some kind of level of negligence here. He has no way of knowing. So therefore, it's really, it would seemingly be called an ones, which means something beyond your control. But even something beyond your control, we know, doesn't mean you're completely off the hook, that you're completely innocent. What the very first confession that we say on the whole list of vidui is al chet shechatanu lefanecha, for the sin that we sinned before you, b'ones uveratzen. B'ones means beyond our control or willingly. So there's a commentary called Pnei Aryan in the Siddur Agra that explains this in the following way. Why are we confessing even a sin that was done bonus? Because if we were worthy, we would not be put in a situation that we have to sin bonus. If Hashem puts us in a situation where we're, so to speak, forced to do a sin, that means there's something wrong. That actually means that there's some other sin that is bringing this upon us. And therefore, even again, it clearly doesn't carry the same responsibility as a regular sin. It doesn't even carry responsibility as a shogeg. It's something, though, in Shamayim that you need to atone. Because if you came to this kind of situation where you were put, you're basically put into a situation where you have to do something wrong, you have to do an act of a sin, because don't forget, you can't say Yaakov, if Yaakov killed a person or really never came to kill him, then you can't say, well, that's not a wrongful act. It is a wrongful act, but there's nothing you can do about it. If a person is put into a situation where he's forced to do a wrongful act, then that's not a good sign. That means that there is something wrong. That means you didn't have the merit. As the Pnei Aryeh says, it means that you have another sin that brought upon this sin upon you. Now, that concept that it could be that because of a sin that you did, now you're forced into a situation to do a sinful act, how do we understand that? How do we understand the connection between the two? So I understand it as that sometimes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when you do a sin, what does Hashem do to show you his displeasure? He sends you a punishment. Sometimes the way he shows you his displeasure is by putting you in a situation where you have to do a sin. So the sin itself, you're not fully responsible for. But if Hashem brought you to a situation where you have to do a sinful act, then that shows that there's something not right. He's not happy. He's not happy. If he's putting you in a situation where basically he's saying you have to act in a way that is not typically the way I want you to act, then that's showing you that Hashem's not happy with you. And that itself now means that itself is a sign that you have to find atonement. You have to seek atonement. Because if you were worthy, you would not have been put in that situation where you have to do this sinful act beyond your control. And therefore, that's what Yaakov was afraid of. Yaakov was afraid that perhaps you're going to have people there that actually never planned on committing a crime. I had a right to kill that person, Yaakov knows, because I had no way of knowing. So halachically, I didn't do anything wrong. But at the end of the day, I killed someone who didn't need to be, wasn't supposed to be killed. My act is a wrongful act. That means there's something wrong with me. That means I have some kind of sin in my record that has brought this upon me. that's therefore why Yaakov was concerned if he has to kill others. That would be the approach of the Gur-Aryeh. Now, to me it's interesting, as I was thinking about this, the fact that, why can't the answer to this question be the following? You know why Yaakov is distressed if he has to kill someone? Is because who wants to kill anybody? Who wants to be put in that situation? I know I have to do it, but I don't want to. But I don't want to. Why? I don't want to be in this situation.
Right.
But let's put it this way: so far, we haven't seen an answer like that. And it would, and perhaps what it really means to say is that if a person is in a situation where 100% without any question, he has the right to kill the person, which means he's obligated to kill the person, then he should rise above his natural feelings and know that I did the will of Hashem and not be distressed over it. That's it. That's possibly what it could mean. But Moshe Feinstein gives an answer that is that is somewhat like this.
Well, I'm thinking about when all this is going on, I'm thinking about this, I mean, follow it. Thing with this cop in Ferguson and the guy he killed, and, you know, I'm thinking about what's going through his mind. You know, I didn't really want to kill him, but I did kill him. Now, you know, it's like something that really happened. I mean, the kid really didn't do anything that deserved to be killed, but
You don't know that.
Well, you don't know, but all I'm saying is I can see all of this.
So what about the kid in Cleveland? What about the kid in Cleveland with the fake, with the toy gun?
Oh, yeah.
What about that one?
I don't think it was that.
Okay, I mean, again, you know.
Yeah.
But how would a person feel about that? Okay, so what did Reb Moshe Feinstein say? Reb Moshe Feinstein says like this. Reb Moshe says that, again, it's similar to what we said before for the Maharal, just with a little bit of a different twist. He says like this. Yaakov Avinu is saying, if Reb Moshe wants to save me, there's nothing limiting Hashem from saving me. He can save me whatever way he wants to. If he wants to save me from Esav, he can save me without having to kill Esav. If it has to be that only way I can be saved is through killing Esav, then there's something wrong.
Yeah.
There's something wrong. If something wrong, if the only way I can save myself is by killing Esav. The Maharal had to turn the act into some kind of a non-halachic act. But Reb Moshe is saying, look, Yaakov Avinu says that if Reb Moshe wants to save me, he has many ways to save me. And if now the only way I'm going to be saved is through killing someone, there's something wrong. There's something wrong if that's the only way that I can be saved. That's Reb Moshe answers. That's how Moshe's answer in Darash Moshe. The Rabbi Zev Lef, in his Sefer on Chumash Yerubina, he also brings an answer for Reb Moshe, but a different answer for Reb Moshe. And the answer that he brings for Reb Moshe is that Yaakov Avinu distresses over killing Esav or anybody else because of the fact that Yaakov is distressing over the fact that although any one of them deserves, as no question, they deserve to be killed, but you know, it would be nice that they would change their minds and not fight and do tshuva. The famous Gemara in Berachos, where Reb Meir had these people that were causing him terrible distress to the point that Reb Meir himself was ready to daven they should die. That means by Reb Meir they deserve to die for what they were doing to him. The Gemara says, his wife Bruria said, instead of praying that they should die, pray that you should do tshuva. Which is a whole discussion on itself, that you should pray to Hashem, that Hashem should influence someone else's free will. But that's what she said. And that was her chiddush, that was her novel idea. Because if Reb Meir was ready for Tadav and they should die, that means they deserve to die. No question. But she said, you know, still, before you decide they should die, give them one more chance. Hope for tshuva. Daven for tshuva. Give them another chance. That's what Yaakov wanted. Yaakov was distressed if he has to kill others, means if I have to kill them, that means that they didn't do tshuva before and they won't have a chance to do tshuva again. Yaakov's wishes are that Esav should just change his whole plan. That Esav should hold back from killing. Esav should do the right thing. That's what he wants. Not that in case Esav does the wrong thing, I have to feel bad for killing him. But the feeling bad for killing him is the whole situation. I wish I wouldn't have to be put in this situation, because I wish that Esau would decide to do the right thing. So although he is 100% deserving to be killed, I wish that he would do tshuva. And the truth is that Reb Moshe, when he asks the question, at least in Darash Moshe, he adds another point to the question when he says, why is Yaakov distressed? So one point is, hey, he has a right to protect himself. The other thing is, why is Yaakov distressed? There is a pasuk that says, I think it's a pasuk, the Ibud Rishayim Rina. With the destruction of the evil, we sing songs of praise to Hashem. So if Esav and his men are killed, they're Rishayim. The world only benefits when the Rishayim are gone. Good. So therefore, Moshe says, but Bruria taught us in the Gemara and Brachas that, yeah, that if it happens that the Rishashem decides to destroy the Rishayim, Rina, we sing songs of praise. We rejoice. But the first thing what we should want is that they should do tshuva. Right. And we hope for tshuva to the last minute. So even though Yaakov Avinu knows that Esav deserves to be destroyed, but that was the lesson of Bruria. You would rather have it that they should change their attitude and change their ways and do the right thing. So if Esav kills him, he's okay with that. But he's distressed over the whole situation that he has to kill him, because he'd rather that Esav should do tshuva. And one last answer to this question. Yeah.
So the good example, he just recently had an experience of that happening with Laban. His Laban was really after him, and then Hashem came to him in a dream.
Okay.
And he did tshuva. He changed his mind. You know, I was really going to hurt you, but, you know, Hashem came to me in a dream, and he told me not to do it. I shouldn't hurt you.
Right.
So he just had an example.
Okay.
He was told by Laban.
Okay.
He came to him in a dream.
Okay.
So, yeah, he could have.
Maybe Yaakov could do this. Hashem would do the same thing, hopefully,
yeah,
for Esau.
Yeah, for Esau, right.
Or something. At least some kind of inspiration. Hopefully. Right.
At least he knew
right.
It was possible.
Right, yeah. And the last answer to share with you is also, Rabbi Lefis brings down, and that is that even if Yaakov is permitted to kill Esav to protect himself, the rule is that when you do something that is normally wrong, even if when you did it you were allowed to do it, it leaves a mark on you. Our actions condition us. Our actions leave a mark on us, even if they were permissible actions. This concept we mentioned many times before, and the famous example is in later on in the Dorim and Parsha Shoftim, the story of Ir Nidachas, when an entire city, you have to wipe them out for worshipping idols. So Hashem says, so there the pasuk says that Hashem will have mercy on you. It says Hashem will have mercy twice. So the Chafetz Chaim, I think the Aruch Chaim there also says that part of the promise that Hashem says is that even though I have commissioned you to murder, and an act of murder now leaves its mark on a person, if you do an act of murder, murder becomes somewhat easier by you. It has an effect on you. It conditions you towards that act. Hashem promises, Klal Yisrael, when they do any dachas, it'll have no effect on them. It'll have no effect. I promise you no effect. That's there by any dachas. Here, Yaakov Avinu is being put into a situation where he has every right to protect himself. But if at the end of the day he kills someone, then that act of murder will leave its mark. Now Yaakov is going to have to battle a whole new battle within himself. Because an act, even if it's an act that you made, that you are allowed to do, but if it's an act that is typically a wrongful act, it leaves its mark, even when you're allowed to do it. It conditions you. It makes it easier for you to do it again. So why is Yaakov distressed? He has to kill others? Not because he has no right to kill them, but he's the fact that if he kills others, that act will leave a negative effect on him.